Welcome to the Next Brave Thing podcast. My name is Ella Hooper, and I believe that breakthrough is on the other side of bravery. This podcast features brave stories, emotional health, and creativity to inspire you to take your next brave step. Welcome back, everyone. Today, I have Strawn Coleman on the podcast, and I'm so excited about this guest because this guest's work has deeply impacted my faith journey and made such an impact on my journey with the Lord. And so Strawn Coleman, probably a lot of people do that. Strawn Coleman is an award-winning musician, poet, and author. He's a spiritual director in New Zealand, and he's the author of 3 prayer volume books, which I'm going to talk about today, and the author of Beholding. But you have a new book, which is called Thirsting, just released. But thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Ella. Thanks for having me. It's really, really great to connect with you and to be here today.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I guess we're going to get into the book and the book, speaking into prayer. And you've really reframed my view on prayer. And actually, like in John 15, it talks about abiding and really giving language to what abiding actually means. We say that a lot in church world, but I'd love to hear a bit of your story and kind of what led you to actually writing the book Beholding.
Yeah, well, I mean, my background is in the arts, and so I've done music for forever since I was 8, and had always had this dream to play music and to share music with the world. And so when I was in my early 20s and I had this kind of connection between my faith and music, I had this moment where I met with God, and it just changed my life. And I kind of started in this passionate pursuit of these two things, of pursuing God and then pursuing to meet with God and share God in the world through music. And I just did it, man. Like, my wife and I, we got married and we just lived the life. You know, we ate toast and spent all our money on instruments and albums and traveled the world just doing kind of, I called myself a musicianary, you know, doing music work. Mm-hmm. But sort of in the midst of that, 5 or 6 years in, I came back from a tour and just had this massive encounter with bad health, like a breakdown, really. Like my body just gave in. It had probably pushed a little bit hard, but also I think that there'd been some health issues since I was a child that hadn't been picked up, that had sort of snowballed and conglomerated. And I just found myself in a life situation where everything fell apart. And, you know, I was sick probably, I don't know, I was probably in bed 70, 80% of the time for a 2 or 3 year period. And, you know, I'd been at Bible college and I'd been in ministry, you know, worked on staff at a church, and I had so many concepts of who God was, and I could preach God's love till I was blue in the face. But I found that when everything fell apart, all my sort of charisma and passion and energy and theology just didn't get me into the place that I needed to be, into God's arms. And so I kind of found myself shipping myself off to a retreat center, like a monastic retreat center, and just day after day, basically staring out a window as my soul unraveled and just sitting in answerless questions and poor health. And really purely by accident, by grace is probably a better word, I began to experience this kind of, it's hard to find language for, maybe this witness with God, this deeper, silent gaze of love between the very depth of my being and Him. And it was a radical change for me. I was used to sort of conscious mental dialogue and charismatic prayer and pressing in and, you know, all those things, which are wonderful. But in this moment, it was like, I'm just going to have to let God love me, and I'm going to have to allow myself to believe that I'm accepted by Him in this kind of state of not being able to offer anything. And it undid me. And so that's the story, that the transformation of that season is sort of where Beholding came from for me.
Wow, that's so powerful. I think the moment that I first got your book, my mom was visiting me in California from Australia, and I'd come out of a really, I think a lot of us coming out of COVID came out of a lot of stress and a lot of just busyness. And I remember sitting in a coffee shop in Napa and my mom just handing me this book, and I opened it up and immediately I was hit with peace and a stillness. Wow. And it's, I think reading your book, I was explaining to you who you are to a friend, and I was like, it's like reading the scripture that, you know, in Matthew, I think it is, where it says, come to me who are all weary and heavy burdened and I will give you rest, is how that book kind of feels it, like it ushers you into. And I think that something that you hit on is moving from transactional prayer into beholding. Because I think I had viewed prayer as I've got all these requests or unanswered prayers, and then connecting with God feels like, yeah, just a little, I think a lot of people struggle with disappointment with unanswered prayer, but I'd love you to speak into, like moving from transactional prayer into beholding prayer.
Yeah, well, transactional prayer for me is this kind of, we have this saying in New Zealand, I don't know if it's a American saying or whatever, but tit for tat, this kind of like give and take thing with God, where sort of I ask for things and he responds by giving. And it's sort of a relationship founded on give and take. And I need things, so God comes through. And then maybe I do a little bit for God and I kind of bank up a little bit of holy kind of savings or something that I can spend on the next prayer request. And, you know, none of us would think this way. I never thought this way. But I think one of the ways that we can tell if we have a transactional prayer life is whether basically prayer to us is only when we are in need of something, or when we are praying for something or around something. But a transactional relationship with God is really just a working relationship. It's a friendship, or it's a communion based only on getting things done, on need. Mm. And weirdly, like, we don't treat other people that way. If we kind of with a friend that only ever rung up whenever we needed something, money, help, or whatever, we wouldn't consider that a deep, vital friendship. And so, what I was trying to do in the book and beholding is invite people to just be with God, and for that to actually mean something, for that to be deep and rich. And so my language for that is beholding, because if in a transactional relationship it's primarily about asking and receiving, in beholding it's really about a mutual gaze of love. And for me, that's kind of down here in the depth of us. It's not a sort of up in the head mental exercise. It's actually learning to, with our soul, receive the beauty and the goodness and the love and the wonder of God our Father. And I think it's a bit like, you know, when you see people really in love, they don't actually say that much, you know. Yeah. Or if you're really with someone in grief, and this is what happened to me when I went through this health crisis, was God never actually answered my prayer. I was constantly asking why questions, you know. Why have you allowed this when I've served you with all my heart? Why won't you heal me? Why won't you at least diagnose me? You know, why won't you show me what's going on? And he never answered those why questions. But what I found him to do was to just sit with me and to just be. And I think that's what I'm, you know, I've been a lot of friends who have grieved. And when someone's really grieving, they don't need some answer, some theological correction about suffering and sin and why good, bad things happen to good people. Mm-hmm. What they actually need is an arm. They need an arm around their shoulder, a hug, and eyes that show that we love and care. Yeah. And in beholding prayer, that's sort of what I'm saying, is it's like, what if prayer was this place we could go to just simply give ourselves and receive from God in the silent language of love? And what if underneath everything we do, including all our intercession and petition and all that, what if underneath all that is this just sustained, mutual, unceasing, restful gaze of love? And that, to me, is prayer.
Yes. And I think they said that loneliness kills more people than cigarettes does. Like, and
yeah,
I've also heard from even research that a lot of the time in healing, healing comes through connection. And so even as you're yep. describing withness, it's actually that something bigger than you is in your circumstances. I would love you talk about in your book, and you mentioned it, just like when you were at that level of pain, you talked about a prayer of acceptance. Can you speak into that? Like, what is a prayer of acceptance?
Yeah, this is a hard one. Yeah, yeah, it is a hard one because, you know, I come from a background that would often see acceptance as maybe a failure of faith. And and I think that's because often what we think of when we say the word acceptance is a kind of stoic resignation. Do you know what I mean? Like, well, I just give up. Things are never going to change. I'm going to be sick forever. This would have been like just talking about my own situation. Like, yeah. I'm going to be sick forever. I may as well just accept it and kind of like just give up hoping. I think that's what a lot of us imagine when we think of acceptance. But I think the way I see acceptance is more of like a holy, godly, hopeful contentment in the midst of unanswered questions and suffering. Yeah. And that's different. I feel like that's psalmic. It's more of like a, God, I will be where I am right now because you are here right now. And I will allow this suffering or this tension or this liminality to be a meeting place for us. But I am always going to be walking and working toward the hope of change and transformation. So for me, like tangibly with chronic sickness, because it's still very real for me today. And, you know, almost actually when Beholding was released, I went through an even worse bout of health than the original. But for me, acceptance kind of looks like, okay, I've woken up. I can feel a migraine coming. I'm probably going to spend hours in bed. I'm going to have to cancel this. I can't play with my kids. And I can do one or two things. I can fight it and just wear myself down with frustration and anxiety, which actually fruits anger and irritability and hopelessness and whatever. Or I can simply say, I'm going to let this thing run through my body and believe and accept that right now the power of the Spirit, the love of God, the gentleness of my Father is alive and well in me, and that I can be in this moment with him. And that's sort of what acceptance is. It's not exhausting myself by fighting everything, but it's not a stoic resignation either. It's kind of a hopeful presentness to who I am and where I am today.
Yeah, and I think that like what you're talking about is honesty. And they say that, well, you know, it's the truth that sets us free. And I think that word truth means reality. Like when we're honest with our reality, we can be set free to his greater reality, you know. And I just love that it's almost like sometimes in our faith life and our walk with the Lord, it feels like there's only A or B, you're following him or not following him. But I feel like you've tapped into secret option C, another way of existing with him, like another way of, doing this walk of life, you know, knowing him as the healer and all of that. And I think when you talk about beholding, you're talking about John 15 talks about abiding, but I'd love to know what does abiding look like for you?
Yeah, so I mean, abiding and beholding really are, to me, the same thing. I guess abiding is probably such a used word in the church, and it's quite vague. I mean, beholding's probably no less vague, but I think for me, when I think of both of those things, I start with the Trinity. I start with God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And they are this community of vital intermingling love. Like they are just unceasingly joyful and happy. They are the party of all parties. God himself is just like nuclear joy and rest and stillness. And then Jesus makes this incredible. And then the word becomes flesh and Jesus becomes humanity. And before he is crucified and resurrected, he says to his disciples, on that day you will realize that I am in my Father and you are in me and I am in you. And he's talking about this profound inness that we are through the Spirit brought into Christ, and Christ is inside this Trinitarian community of God. And therefore, we have been pulled into this communion of Father, Son, and Spirit to experience Him from within and through this life in the Spirit. So I think when you think of it like that, when you think that we don't start the conversation of prayer, that this conversation is ongoing all the time, we are simply choosing to consciously into the reality of what is already taking place within us. The Son is talking to the Father through the Spirit within us, and the Spirit is crying out to the Father through us with groans beyond understanding. So if that's true, then abiding is kind of learning to live from this nest of love that is God that we've been pulled into. And if it is true, then it is kind of like a spiritual language that we have to learn. It's not conscious mental dialogue. It's clearly not physical. You know, I'd love for Jesus to physically be here right now, that I could hang out with him and have a coffee. And so abiding for me is actually learning to not go outside of myself to find God, but to continually look to the Holy Spirit and grow a sensitivity to the Holy Spirit within me, so that I can sit in him, so I can live from that place. And that's lots of things. That means living the teaching of Jesus, because the teachings of Jesus are just a blueprint for intimacy. Yeah. Teachings of Jesus are just Jesus' way of saying, if you want to be intimate with me, this is the way. So it's living that. It's practicing prayer for me. And prayer, it just means sitting silently and just opening up the depth of my soul and being vulnerable and just saying, here I am. And imagining God's love and his light just saturating the depth of my soul, and just sitting there in this quiet gaze for 15 minutes, half an hour, an hour, as long as I can. So I think abiding for me, it starts with the Trinity. It starts from prayer isn't pulling God in. Prayer is us consciously awakening to God within, which is the promise of the Holy Spirit sent at Pentecost. And it's about sustaining this gaze, this kind of sense of stillness, and living from that place, which is really trained by spiritual practices and by living Jesus' way. Yeah. Hope that doesn't sound too crazy and ethereal.
No, I love it. I think that you actually have a great gift on giving language to something that is quite abstract. And I just think that speaking of practices, something that you talk about in the book, which is my favorite, because I think I often feel quite disoriented or like noisy internally with screens and social media and emails, like questions and requests and things kind of coming at me. And something that I think reading your book, it was always such an invitation to get quiet and still. And a lot of people, like I've done an exercise with my students where I said, we're just going to sit in silence. And I don't tell them how long we're going to sit in silence, but it's more of like a self-awareness exercise of like, how did you feel when we had to sit in silence? And what comes up in us? And I think, like, I love that you talk about like actually building in spiritual practices. And but tell me I would love to know more about like the power of stillness or silence, like if you could speak into like getting silent, because a lot of people would be like, well, then nothing's there and just my thoughts. And so I'd love to hear for you to speak into silence.
Well, I think we have so many interesting issues as kind of post-enlightened materialist Westerners, which sounds really metaphysical, sorry, but you know, we think a lot, we struggle with terms like silence. So what I mean by that is, for us, when we think silence, we think absence. We think silence is the absence of sound, it's the absence of conversation, it's the absence of anything. Just like a lot of the time we think peace is just the absence of conflict, right? But in the biblical framework of peace, shalom is actually the presence of the kingdom of heaven. It's the presence of you know, interrelation, healthy interrelations and joy and justice. So when we think of silence, our brain automatically goes to emptiness. But silence itself is a language, you know, kind of already talked about this a little bit earlier, in the sense that if someone's grieving, silence is actually one of the greatest things we can communicate. I was in a conversation recently with someone in their 70s who was just opening up. It was at church. They were opening up for the first time about abuse that they'd received as a seven-year-old. So imagine that, 70 years.
Yeah, wow.
And it was taking a long time for her to talk about it because she never talked about it before. And it required a lot of silence on my part, you know. And that silence wasn't the absence of something. It was actually the pregnancy of love. It was the, wow, the fullness of my love. And to speak would have been more absent than to simply be there present. And so I think when it comes to the role of silence, I mean, think about a child. A child in the uterus is silent, yet it grows and is vital and communes with the mother in all kinds of interesting,
wow,
and meaningful, substantial ways. A seed germinates under soil in silence. The sun rises in silence. Oxygen is silent, and yet without oxygen, we would die in an instant. So if we transform our definition of silence as to things that essentially speak another language, and we apply that to God, and we say, well, love is not a conversation. Love is not a letter in the mail. Love is this, I mean, what is love? I don't know. It's this deep felt expression of acceptance and wonder and wholeness. So love is silent. And so therefore, if God is spirit and he has no kind of physical voice box and everything, I know I'm not talking about Jesus, then we want to commune with God in his language. And for me, entering silence is not about emptying my mind and getting rid of all my thoughts. That's transcendental meditation. That's actually not Christian. And I was talking to a friend about this recently because he's trying to meditate a lot. And he says, do you meditate? And I said, no, I pray. And he's like, well, isn't that just meditation? I said, no, because in meditation, what you're trying to do is empty yourself just for the sake of reaching some kind of nirvana or some kind of peace state. But what I'm doing is I'm allowing myself to be filled with a person. Mm-hmm. I'm actually anticipating the full infilling of my being with the person of God, who is love, joy, peace, patience. Mm-hmm. And that's what silence does. It's not, I'm going to remove everything from myself and empty myself. Silence is like, you know what, I'm just going to shut up for a minute so that God can actually fill me and I can be present to him. So bit of a mini sermon there, sorry, but that I think it starts so with good. Seeing silence not as emptiness, but the true fullness. Yeah.
Wow. And I think that I love the Passion Translation of the Bible. I'm not sure if you've read it, but in the Proverbs it says, Proverbs 3, it says, wisdom comes when you adore him with undivided devotion. I think in that adoration, there requires some silence, you know, in just beholding him. And I've been in situations where I literally, I think we've been in situations where you're at the end of yourself, basically, which is the best, God's favorite place, I'm sure. But I've always felt like wisdom coming in by getting still first before like rushing and praying and trying to solve it on my own. I don't know if you have any testimonies of like moments of fruit where you're like, whoa, it's because I was silent that happened. Or do you have any kind of moments of testimony where you've kind of like, oh, that's what happens? I mean, you kind of have shared it, but any other things to add there?
Oh, man. I mean, all of my greatest meetings with the Lord have come in times when I've been totally silent. when I think about it, you know, and even practically I think about the birth of my children and holding a child and no one dares talk. It's just awestruck wonder. It's the same as staring at a piece of art. You look at a piece of art and a true piece of art stills you. It just stops you. So, but you know, so I've got plenty of personal examples, but I think what I've seen the most, the clearest I've seen it, is that I used to work at a kind of charismatic young sort of non-denominational church as a prayer curator. And, I used to try and run these charismatic meetings because that was my background, and we were just this growing young adult church, and not very many people were keen on these prayer meetings, and I thought, no one wants to pray. And then one day this person came and said, well, I've just been to a spiritual retreat. Should we try that? And my opinion was like, look, I can't get these guys to church 20 minutes early to pray, and you want to do like a full one day of silence on a Saturday? It costs like $70 or something.
Yeah.
But we started doing these retreats, and all I did was say, we're going to make room for God. We're going to go and be with him and be still and just let him be. And people went off, and then they would come back and they would say, oh, I didn't really have any kind of mountaintop experience today. But, you know, about an hour into the silence, I just started to weep. Mm-hmm. And I just wept for like 35 minutes. And at the end of it, I felt free from dot, dot, dot.
Wow.
You know, another person said, I had no kind of crazy encounter with God today, but, you know, I went for a walk, and while I was walking, I finally forgave my abuser. I finally forgave the person who betrayed me. And you could see that as it was coming out of their mouth, they were like, oh my goodness, this is massive. But because it wasn't some altar call, high intensity moment where the lights were flashing, they hadn't acknowledged the importance of it.
Mm.
Another one, I mean, I've on these retreats, I've seen people experience God's presence for the first time, hear the Holy Spirit's voice for the first time. I had one guy, he came back from an extended period of silence at retreat, and he was shaking like this, and he was just looking at me all wild. And I was like, are you okay? And he was like, I'm really out of it, man. I don't know what to say. And I was like, well, just say something, because I'm kind of nervous about whether you're okay. And he said, since the day he could remember as a child, he's had ADHD. His mouth, his mind has just been manic all the time. He's never been able to have a still mind. And he said, when I sent him into silence, he was freaking out about how loud it was going to be. But he said he just went and lay down on a bank, and he sat there and looked up at the sky, and God's presence filled him. And he said, I have had 2 hours of complete stillness in my mind. And I feel incredible. And he had never experienced it in his whole life.
Mm.
Now, if that had been some altar call at a conference or something, you know, someone would be jumping up with a mic and, you know, telling a story. But, you know, all of these were just very ordinary, you know, like the ministry was sending people into God to be with him themselves. Yeah. And in that silence, I've just seen profound and amazing things happen.
Yeah. Oh, these are my favorite kind of testimonies. Just because we're just so in deep need for a sound mind. And so it's so powerful. And so you kind of mentioned a little bit, like, from the silence, you know, you've birthed these books and this beautiful poetry and creativity. And because I work with creatives, I would love for you to speak to, I'm going to read some of your amazing prayers from volume 3. But I think on one of your prayers, you say that creativity is the art of catching wind, and so is prayer. I'd love, just for all my creatives listening, they're going to want to know, like, what's your creative process, and what's that look like for you? Being inspired to create these books.
My creative process. Oh, gosh. I have always felt really, I've always felt really out of control in my creative process. I've never really been a cognitive person in my creative expression. So when I was writing music, I would wait. I would feel this thing in me, a tug or a prayer. Really, it was a groan. I think the language I would say now, it was a groan. And I would live a spacious life, lots of journaling, a lot of prayer journaling in the morning, processing my thoughts, emotions, praying, having conversation with God. Then I would have lots of space, and I would try and be sensitive to the nudges of these groans. Mm. And when these groans came out, I would just go grab a guitar, I would hit record on my phone, and I would just sing.
Mm.
And this sounds crazy to me now, because it's actually been a while since this has happened. but songs would just come out. And a lot of the time it would be like verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, outro, done. And it would just all happen in 10 minutes. And I would go back and just kind of nudge some of the lyrics and move some of the melodies. But and I think I didn't understand at the time, but I think the way I see it now, and this is true of my writing as well, is that if I deaden enough noise in my life, if I get rid of the reading or the social media, the reels, if I get rid of the noise, the podcasts, the sounds, the busy-mindedness, the busy schedule, and I listen for that conversation of the Trinity within me, I will feel these moments and these nudges, and what I want to do is just lean into that and then just not overthink it but let it flow. And that's how Beholding happened. Beholding was just I would sit with my fingers on a keyboard, sometimes for 45 minutes or an hour. I would just wait. And then when that nudge came, I would just write. And I wouldn't care what the subject was. I wouldn't check it with my mind. I would just stream of consciousness it out. And that was, for me, the way that it came out. But for me too, like, creativity is about prayer. And I think I realized that looking back, is that all my work is prayer, all my songs, all my books, everything. So I think there's a sense for me in which I'm wanting to allow the Trinity to express himself through my person, through my personality. But I want everything that I do, and this is so important with my writing, I want nobody to be able to read a line or two of my writing without being like, "Oh, I need to pray." I want to constantly invite people into an experience. I'm not interested in communicating more information or content. Yeah. I want someone to be forced to stop and to go, "Whoa." And so for me, it's like, I need to let God do that, because I don't know. I have no idea how to do that. So is that a process? I don't know. It's what I do.
Like I'm geeking out right now. Like, I love this stuff. this is awesome, because literally I said to someone, when you read this book, it's not like I'm listening to another sermon and hearing someone else's connection to the Lord. It is like I'll put your book down, because it's like I want to create space to actually hear him for myself, not wait for another prophetic word, and or not even waiting for Strawn to tell me something that God thinks about me. It's like, no, I'm actually being ushered in to hear him for myself. Something that is super powerful, I'm going to read one of your prayers. I sent this to a friend, and she said to me after she read it, she was like, "What a relief." And I'll read it. It says, and you kind of mentioned this when you were talking about creativity, but it says, "You restore me to myself, the self I never knew I was, the self that you had hidden in you since the dawn of this great age." And then it says, "May you allow God to uncover you layer by layer, lie by lie, showing you who you really are, making you yourself." And man, I think I even read that now and I feel permission to like be, because I think in Christianity, and I think because I work with artists a lot, is there's a lot of expectations on who we should be or how Christians should behave. And it can feel really like leaning forward and striving. Whereas this kind of helps you go, "Oh, what a relief. I can just be myself." You sort of mentioned through creativity, you're wanting like God to come through your personhood. Like, there's no one like Strawn, just like there's no one like Ella. I'd love for you to, where did this come from, or this, what's the history of this prayer poem?
Oh, I mean, I am a stubborn, thick, ignorant human being, and I mean that in not in a self-deprecating way. Like, it is just in my nature. I've always been that way since I was a kid. You know, I have these ideas about things and I want to make them happen, and I really can. and what chronic sickness has done to me. And I guess maybe this is part of the natural process of getting into your 30s and, you know, bridging midlife, is you start to realize that all these things you've been working hard trying to change, you just can't. Mm-hmm. And then actually a lot of the time you think the things are that are the most important, you're completely wrong because you've been completely blind to yourself in another whole period. And I think that where I used to see the role of Christian spirituality or of faith or of discipleship, whatever language you want to use, was to bring myself into being something, you know, to be more Christ-like, to be more loving.
Yes, yes.
I think now I realize that it's the opposite direction. I have to let myself be taken hold of by God. I have to give myself to the project of being shaped by God in His way, on His timing, because all the willpower in the world can't make someone divinely loving or divinely patient.
So good.
And so, but the thing is, the processes are so different. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you think it's your job to shape yourself into ... more loving, more faithful, more whatever, you are going to push hard, you're going to work hard, you're going to force your life into this position, and all of that stuff's wonderful, and there is an absolute place for willpower. But if you think that your job is to submit to the work of God in shaping you, if your main role is consent, so that God can make you the you really are, not the one you think you should be or wish you were, or some conception in your head of what a real Christian's meant to look like.
Yeah.
If you want to do that other process of letting, that requires a huge amount of soaking in God's presence, of trust, of radical vulnerability, of a willingness to be naked and bare with God in our inner souls, in this place of like, I don't like this mess right now, God, but I'm trusting you in the process, and so I'm going to rest in you here. Mm. It requires silence. It requires receiving love. And so I think the whole, if we switch into this, I have to let the Trinity shape me into Him by loving me.
Mm-hmm.
That changes how I pray. It changes how I live my life. It lets me exhale and stop and just go, oh God, I say yes. And, you know, in this, I've dedicated a whole sort of two or three chapters in this, my latest book, Thirsting, about what it actually means to just give consent. You know, Revelation 3:20, Jesus says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. Mm-hmm. If anyone answers, I will come in with him and dine with him.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the instigator? Who's the initiator? It's Jesus. Who's the blockage? It's not God who's distant. It's us who's distant. And what does Jesus do when we open up in our places of shame and frustration and disappointment? What do? He comes in and He dines with us.
Hmm.
So for me, this whole like, I don't know who I'm meant to be because I'm so culturally loaded. I'm so like church-wise loaded. I mean, every 10 years, someone has a different idea about what the ideal Christian looks like, right? You know, right now, it's like influencer meets CEO meets like supermodel meets I don't know what.
I know, it's so true.
I don't know. I have to let God let me know, tell me.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to do that, it can't be a mental exercise.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be willpower driven on that my part. It has to be me constantly opening up and being vulnerable and saying, okay, just come and do your work. Just come. I just say yes. I say yes. And that is so restful and liberating.
Yes. Oh, it's so beautiful. And it takes the pressure off. And speaking of, you've just mentioned the book Thirsting, and I might come back to one more of your prayers towards the end. But in your book Thirsting, in chapter 2, you say, we are all searching, all of us, for so many things, for love, for meaning, for success. Sometimes that searching is more of a running from something, be it trauma, disappointment, or fear. But most of the time, it's simply an attempt to fill our spiritual stomachs, to relieve the existential hunger we feel but can't touch and name. You know, reading the book Thirsting, it's like beholding kind of sets a table, and then you go even deeper in your book Thirsting, which is so powerful and especially so relevant when we have terms like binge watching TV shows, like we're so hungry and, you know, parched for something beyond us. And I'd love to hear what led you to writing the book Thirsting.
Well, I mean, we've already talked about this story of years ago, you know, maybe 7-8 years ago when I started with chronic illness. And I kind of came through that. But what happened was in 2020, my family and I moved from this kind of large city in Auckland, in New Zealand called Auckland, is 1.8 million people, to a small beachside town of 1,400 people. And not only that, but it's the most, I found out later, it's the most aged population in New Zealand. So, we, you know, we're this young family, we move into this town that's basically all retirees. Our church is like 40, 70-year-olds. We're the only people under 70 in our church. We just celebrated some guy's 90th birthday a couple of weeks ago at after church on the service.
Oh, that's crazy.
And so we moved to this small town, and then COVID hit and the borders closed. And so I lost all my work. And then I got incredibly sick again. In fact, this time I genuinely thought I'm dying. I was getting ready to just leave my wife. It was so dramatic.
Yeah.
And I found myself again that, you know, sitting in the space of restriction. And the difference was in Auckland was that there was cafes, there was people, there was like the white noise of humanity just everywhere. And so even when I was sick, I could go to a cafe and just and be around. But down here, it was like long, dark winters and incredible simplicity and quiet. It was like, to me, the what I imagine the Desert Fathers must have experienced when they went into the wilderness, you know, and lived in caves. And I found myself for the first time confronting just how ravenous my desire was. It was like I wanted to reach for anything to fill the pain I felt, the disappointment that I was sick again, the anger that my life was being taken away, the boredom, the excruciating boredom. I just wanted to watch Netflix or just, I don't know, eat more roasts or chocolate or whatever. And in that process, I think God confronted me one day and just said, "Do you see how much desire you have and how little you've been spending it on me?"
Wow.
And that was confronting for me because I spent a lot of my life in prayer. Yeah. But I think that it was a deeper revelation of just how much in our culture and our time we are satisfying ourselves in a million little ways on just this little bit of time on Reels or this movie or this drink or this meal or this outing. And we think that these things are what we want. And it's only because we're so used to spending our thirst in all of these places that we don't know how to gather it up into God. Yeah. And so I this book came from my own. It's all the learnings over the last 4 years of me going, how do I reckon with this fire and actually learn to drink God and not just drink all these other little things, but take Jesus' invitation to come and drink seriously. And I kind of just poured all my heart and all my prayer into writing a book that I hope will help others at least start a similar journey. So, that's sort of how I came to write this one.
And it's so powerful because what you were saying in the book, you're sort of saying like, because a lot of people feel like once I get married, then the desire will be fulfilled, the thirst will be filled. Or once I get win the Oscar, then that thirst will be quenched. And you actually talk about like how all of those things are fleeting, but God is constant. And I'd love you to speak into just finding that consistent, constant quench of thirst in God.
Well, I think it's just a long process of facing pain to start. Do you know what I mean? Because, and by pain, I mean that broadly in the sense that these aches that we feel, I mean, I think it starts by just waking up every morning and acknowledging, you know what, one more book sale, one more like on Instagram, you know, a better body is temporal. And I cannot fix an existential/spiritual thirst with anything other than eternity. And I think even just acknowledging that and saying that, I mean, that's just not common parlay in our world. And honestly, probably not even in the church, because I find all we do in the church is replace it with, if only my ministry was better, or I was more anointed if you're from a charismatic past, or if only my biblical knowledge was better, or if only, you know, this mission or my community or my church, or we just replace it with more holy versions. But I think we have to start and say, like, this thing is so deep in me that only God can satisfy it. And I think when we begin there, we turn away from the world. And then the second thing that I try and do is I try to recognize my pain points. And by that I mean, like, oh, I just really want to just sit down and watch a movie, which is an exhausted statement. Now, why am I exhausted? Really, why am I exhausted? Is it because I've been busy, or is it because I'm anxious? Is it because I'm busy-minded? Is it because I'm avoiding some deep insecurity or pain? So what I want to do is just look to those, like when I reach for a drink, when I reach for a movie, when I'm obsessing over selling more music or obsessing over book sales, I want to stop and go, I can feel that. Holy Spirit, show me what the desire or the malfunction at the base of that thirst is. And it will be something like insecurity or, you know, anxiety or fear or self-hate or... And then I would just want to say, okay, would you just be with me in this? Not like mentally, will you fix it, whatever, but would you flood me with your presence and help me not to feel so insecure and to find my identity in what I do? Would you flood me with your presence and let me be so satisfied right now with an experience of your love that I don't want to reach for that drink? That I don't need to pig out on a chocolate bar, whatever it is. So I think it begins with reminding ourselves that none of these external things can satisfy. They're simply doorways that we walk through into it, you know, the eternal experience of God. And then secondly, I want to use my pain as cues. I want to let them almost be like monastic bells that call me to prayer. Oh, the stuff. Oh, what I'm using. All these habits. Okay. What's at the base of that, Holy Spirit? And then how can I experience you in the midst of it? And in those two ways, I think we begin to detach from our desires for the world, or at least redeem them. And then secondly, begin to experience drinking of God's presence instead of trying to ravenously drink the world.
Yeah, that's so powerful. Thank you for breaking that down, because really, I mean, psychologists, I think, call that regulation, like you're regulating, right. Like the Psalms almost, and getting curious about where that pain comes from. I think that's language we need to hear. That's so good. I love that. And I think, in your book you talk about, numbing and where that sort of comes from. And I think a lot of us, you get to the point where you have binge watched that whole TV series and then you just feel kind of empty. And what's beautiful is that in your book, you're really talking about the place that doesn't run dry, which is so beautiful. And I think it's so beautiful. Like it sounds like a book that cost you, because it sounds like a book that... It's quite intimate and like, but also it's like I think you're hitting so deeply at the core of our human need. And did it feel risky to put out a book like this for you? Because I love that you give a danger warning at the beginning. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be good.
This book for sure has been the most costly work I've ever done in my life. I cannot tell you the depths of self-confrontation and work with God and actually just feelings of inadequacy at even at languaging something so intangible and deep and vast. I found, and there's definitely some vulnerable parts in this book that, you know, even to this day I read them and I just go, Lord have mercy. You know, I try to open up myself in the process. This book was hard, which is ironic because I thought it would be the easiest book. I thought it would be easy, but I think what I found was it was almost like God was like, okay, so you want to write a book about being vulnerable and thirsting, and let's go on a journey together, Strawn. And honestly, I mean, I was just many days at the end of the day, just almost completely falling apart and just saying to Katie, I know God is with me. I know he loves me. But right now I just feel utterly, you know, just confronted and exhausted. And it was a costly book. But I think too, this last probably 3 or 4 years of my life, I feel like God has been more to me than I could ever have imagined. And I feel like I have learned to receive his love and to love him in ways that I've always dreamt of. But it has looked nothing like. It has looked like my desolation and my crucifixion, and not like the glorious, hyper spiritual, amazing, cloud nine levitating, floating around the place spirituality that I'd hoped for, or I'd imagined. But I would say that the cruciform love I've experienced in these years is deeper and greater than anything I could have imagined in myself. So I'm truly grateful for it.
Yeah, it's beautiful because I think that it's. Yeah, I love how I think it, I don't want to say it should be costly, but I think that beautiful gifts in our life, or like meaning, living a meaningful life or a full life or a whole life, requires some level of death, like, or cost, know? So, and it's so beautiful, like, or I think the, your level of vulnerability invites us to that level of breakthrough. So I just appreciate you being vulnerable and, leading us into that direction and carrying so much. It's so the scripture that says that in our weakness, his power is made perfect. And so that's why I think vulnerability is powerful. But I would love to sort of close out our time with kind of one of my favorite prayers that you've written, and it's my favorite because I'm a risk taker, which then leaves me, I normally find myself in uncertain places. And then sometimes I feel judgment towards myself because I'm like, oh, I shouldn't, if I had have known this. I think because I pastor and then also life coach people, they're always talking they want their control so bad. They want to know something. So I'd love to read this and have you speak to the hearts of those listening who might find themselves in uncertain seasons. But you say, may you see your lack of clarity as a resting place in God, a stretching place that makes more room for him, not less, and an opportunity to walk with love in answerless affection. And then it says, misdwelling spirit who sees when I don't see and knows when I don't know, help me to see my lack of clarity as a holy invitation and an opportunity to walk with you in answerless devotion. And it's just, even reading that now, I just feel a sense of what a delight to be uncertain about things. Like, it just reframes uncertainty. So I'd love you to, I'd love to hear a bit of context to how you wrote it. But speak to uncertainty. Yeah.
I mean, for me, uncertainty has probably been the only certainty that I've had in my whole adult life. You know, I mean, I think it comes part and parcel with the arts. So I think if you're in the arts, there's a sense in which it's easier to get used to it because that's just how the industry is built, you know. I mean, of all the jobs, I'm going to be a musician. Well, there's zero career path. You know, there's no like entry level. You start here and you work your way up. It's purely just who knows what's going to happen.
So true.
And so I think in some sense, I've always felt uncertain. And I thought that would change with time, and I thought it would change the closer I got to God. But I think the more intimate I become with him, the more I realize that to truly love him is to truly give up on my understanding and my knowing of things, and to allow his life to just minute by minute, moment by moment, bring about the mosaic that he is painting in my life. And so uncertainty in that sense actually becomes essential and beautiful, and not an issue. And I think of in between times, I think of like, when does everybody go out and take photos of the sky? It's not when the sun's at high, when everything's clear. It's not when everything's black and you just got no idea. It's right in the middle. It's right in the uncertain moment where the sun's rising and it casts this beautiful light. And I think that's what we experience in uncertainty. We experience the beauty of God in this mysterious moment of I got no idea what's going on. And it's more exciting. It's more engulfing. There's something more true about it. And I think, you know, chronic sickness has taught me this. But I think in any shape or form, if we are moving toward God, we are moving toward greater uncertainty. And I believe that because I look at the apostles and I look at the early church and I go, these guys didn't have much of a clue what was going on. Do you know what I mean? I look at the disciples. I think the closer you look at the gospels, the closer people get to Jesus, the more disoriented. And so I think that the life we live, a faithful life, is a disorienting, uncertain life. And I used to think that this fogginess of my vision and understanding was a sign that I just wasn't faithful enough. Like I just, maybe I'm not hearing from God in prayer. Maybe I don't have wisdom. Maybe I just, I can't hear him. Maybe I'm the problem here. But now when the fog settles into my life, I go, hallelujah, God is moving. I got no idea what's going on. Yeah. I have no idea how I'm going to make it through today or tomorrow. God's presence has come near. And that is a vastly different posture than I used to feel in faith. And so that that prayer for me is kind of my expression of making uncertainty holy, making it an attribute of the kingdom of heaven and embracing it as an act of faith and of fidelity and love towards God who says, just come with me. Just give up everything and come with me and I'll show you.
Wow, that's so powerful. And what a beautiful way to sort of release our listeners and end our podcast. Thank you so much for sharing your creative process and, and sharing your history with God with us, because I think you've really invited us into a hunger to thirst for Him. But I think as you're sharing, you're painting a picture of a really good God. And a lot of people from different backgrounds and different pain inside religion maybe have views of God that, may feel like it's scary to trust our uncertainty with God if he's really mean or a narcissist in the sky or something. Like, I'd love to know, I'd love for you to share, just sort of in closing, your view. I mean, you have throughout the podcast, but maybe your view of God and how that's, ever unfolding thing.
God is just unceasing love that knows how to be no other way. And I think that if you can see this Trinity of Father, Son, and Spirit, who experience love as completely engulfing in one another, that the goal isn't just to love at arm's length or from even beside or adjacent, but to literally be in the very object of their affection. And that Jesus was the sign of that, and he sends his Spirit. Then God is a pursuing God who yearns for us. He desires us. He created us not out because he needed us. I mean, he was in perfect communion. God literally created us just to love us. I mean, it's just, he just desires us. You know, the gospel isn't man's search for God. The gospel is God's search for man.
Wow.
And so I think if we can see Jesus knocking on the door, let me in. Why? Not so I can, that's 3:20, Revelation 3:20. It doesn't say, if you open the door, I will come in and I will sort you out and I'll tell you what's right and what's wrong and I'll move the furniture. He doesn't. He says, I just want to come in and dine with you like any lover, like any friend, except more than ever. So for me, God is just unceasing love. He cannot help it. It is who he is. He doesn't do love. He is love. And therefore, our entire existence is not about performance. It's not about even understanding that, because we never can. Truly, we can't. It's beyond our understanding. It's simply just to say, okay, I say yes, just show me. And God is just waiting for that. That's all he waits for. It's all he longs. He aches every day. He yearns. Just say yes. Just let me love you. That's who God is.
So powerful. Wow. Well, Strawn, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. That's such a beautiful way to end us there. And our listeners can by the time this podcast comes out, the book Thirsting will be released. And you can also find Beholding and the three prayer volumes on your website, Commoners Communion. And we'll have the link, all the links to that in the show notes. But thank you so much again for coming on the podcast, Strawn.
Thank you, Ella. It's been a pleasure. Really appreciate you.
Thanks for listening today. Please download, share with your friends, and write a review. If you would like to book in a life coaching session with me, go to my website at www.ella-hooper.com or follow me on Instagram at Next Brave Thing Podcast.